Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Hello and welcome to a situation which by any estimation needs to be called excellent. We're talking about nuclear deterrence, strategic deterrence. This is the inaugural podcast of a really cutting edge and important new series. It's part of what you've heard of with the NucleCast podcast. This is called a future series, where it's with Warrior Maven and the Advanced Nuclear Weapons Alliance partnered to bring you this. Hopefully you'll find this added value about these important and pressing issues. And for our inaugural episode, we have a rock star guest, one of the top experts in low yield and nuclear weapons across the board. His name is Mr. James Howe. He is an extremely accomplished, decades of research. He currently wears a number of hats. He serves as the Threats Requirements VP of Vision Centric, which is an entity that supports both RICTO and STRATCOM. And a lot of you listeners are probably so smart and sophisticated, you don't even need to hear these acronyms. But of course, one of them, Rapid Capabilities Critical Technologies Office, very well known for hypersonics and other emerging technologies. Mr. Howe also supports the National Security Research Institute, which supports Strategic Command. Of course, we all are familiar with that, the backbone of the Pentagon's nuclear weapons arm. So we have a lot to cover. Let's get right to our expert, Mr. Howe. How you doing? Great to have you. I look forward to talking to you.
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Excellent, sir. Well, some of your research, we're going to focus today very much on low yield and the idea of theater and tactical nuclear weapons, both with the threat equation in terms of Russia and China, as well as, of course, what the United States is doing. So I'd love to begin, if you will, sir, and then we can talk a little bit about each arsenal from the various countries and address the threat scenario. But initially, let's talk low yield in general. Years ago, I showed up at a congressional hearing and members of Congress were asking then Secretary Mattis, isn't this going to lower the threshold to nuclear war? And of course, this was around the time with the Trump administration's 2018 nuclear posture review called for lower yield nuclear weapons. Now, of course, we have a Trident variant that's armed with low yield variants. The SLCM, or the submarine launched cruise missile that's nuclear, has been resurrected. And my question to you is, what's your concept in terms of strategic deterrence? What's your thinking about low yield? Do they lower that threshold or essentially help keep the peace?
Well, let me start with Russia's view. This started back around 1999. Mikhailov, who then was the Minister of Atomic Energy for Russia, proposed developing a force of 10,000 highly accurate, low-yield nuclear weapons once again make them an instrument of policy. In other words, they would be usable. And Yeltsin signed off on that, and so they then started development. We know there has been testing. The testing included both the biologic targets, electronic targets, to include space systems, and EMP targets, or X-rays, X-ray and EMP also. So they have been spending decades now developing these low-yield weapons. What we don't know is how many they actually have deployed. We have General Hyten's statement recently that they have thousands, but what does that actually translate into in terms of force structure? Publicly, we simply don't know. But they can build somewhere around 1,000 to 3,000 a year, and that's been confirmed by General Ashley, who's Director of DIA. That was back in 2019.
Well, that's pretty massive if you think about the production capacity, because one of the things we often hear with regard to Russia is that there may be some cutting edge, paradigm changing weapons, but is there then the commensurate ability to produce them at scale in a way that would be relevant or impactful in a potential great power scenario? You recall, sir, one of the things that then Secretary Mattis said was the idea is to bring Russia back to the negotiating table, not necessarily lower the threshold or increase the likelihood of an actual nuclear exchange. The question of whether a tactical nuclear exchange is in any way winnable, that pertains to a really, I'm interested in your thoughts on this question. How realistic is the Putin threat of nuclear weapons? Clearly, many experts have probably done psychological profiles. He's known as a rational guy, a survivalist. Is he really going to use tactical weapons? And if so, isn't he conscious of what the implications of that might be? So let's talk just in a general sense with all these dual-use weapons. What's the scope of the threat posed by Russia with the actual use of nuclear weapons?
Well, Putin is also a risk taker. And Russia is a nation that's in decline, and so they will, in fact, be willing to accept more risk. They wouldn't make this investment in these low-yield weapons if they didn't feel at some point they would have to use them. This is not a demonstration force. This is a warfighting force that they're developing, and we'll just have to wait and see how things develop as to what happens both with Ukraine. If you recall back in the fall of 23, we were very concerned at that point that Russia was in fact going to use one or more weapons. China has come down very strongly saying they do not support nuclear use, and I think that was a major factor in Russia probably not using them at one, and they currently feel that time is on their side, even though they're facing severe societal and economic issues. Whether time is on their side is another issue, but currently I guess they feel that time is on their side, so they do not yet feel pushed to where they're going to have to use.
Well, it seems that there's a real argument in support of the need for low yield, because one of the things your research shows is the actual size of the arsenal is a massive discrepancy or deficit between the amount of low yield or tactical nuclear weapons Russia is known to possess and what the U.S. is now revving up. Obviously, there are efforts underway, a lot of progress being made. What's your sense of the need for that? And then let's talk about the scope and the seriousness of the Russian tactical theater nuclear threat.
Well, right now, in terms of tactical nuclear weapons, U.S. has approximately 400 B-61 bombs, and approximately 200 of those are over in Europe. Conversely, Russia has approximately 2,000, according to a number of analysts, but other analysts, knowledgeable, believe that it's more likely 5,000 or even 10,000. If you may recall, back at the back in 1991, at the height of the Cold War, when it ended, at that point Russia had, I believe it was 21,700 weapons, tactical weapons that they felt they needed to be able to conduct war in Europe. So, and if you actually do a loadout of the current Russian forces with the nominal nuclear loads that they would carry, you come up with about 6,000. And so whether they had, and also if you look at, once again, Russia covers 11 time zones. They have, I think it's a number of fleets, armies, and air forces. And there's also 20 different type weapons, and when you try to sort all that out and allocate 2,000 among all those, you come up with a significant shortage. So what do they actually need in the way of theater forces to actually conduct war when you look at not only NATO scenarios, but also potential China scenarios? I think it's going to be far more than 2,000. And the U.S. with 400... we're at a significant deficit. Part of that, a large part, simply can be made up not with necessarily nuclear weapons, but stronger defenses. Because if you look at the capability of the defenses in Europe, or Ukraine, where they're essentially 70 to 90% effective, and the Norwegian NSAMs is 94% effective, and where the Patriot is even able to intercept the Kinzhal. So defenses are a very major player, and they can be deployed far quicker than additional warheads can, although if for theater weapons, if we needed to expand that, we could have approximately another 1,000 warheads in 1 to 3 years, depending on criteria we establish, without too much of an impact on the strategic warhead programs of record. So there are things that we can do.
What comes to mind is this idea of mass matter, Sun Tzu, right? We've all heard of this for many years. And if I recall, there was Admiral Richard, the former commander of STRATCOM, used to talk about, bolt out of the blue, the risk or the concern about a salvo of incoming missiles. Sure enough, you provided really significant context as to the size, scope, and threat of Russia's tactical nuclear arsenal. Very significant situation. And one would think that there has to, of course, as you referred to, be credible missile defense. But there's also a need to arguably have a comparable deterrent in the form of low yield, which reminds me of what you mentioned. I was interested that you mentioned the B-61. Of course, the U.S. with Mod 12 takes all these different variants, puts them into a single bomb. There are low yield variants now with the B-61, whether it's earth penetrating or an area detonation. Do you think Russia, and this is where I'm going with this, forgive the long windup, but with the Su-57 being spotted in Iran, the F-35 is slated to be a nuclear carrier. Could Iran or potentially even Russia arm that Su-57 with some kind of nuclear capability and low yield or even with a variety of options?
Oh, I'd be very surprised if the Su-57 wasn't... one of the requirements wasn't the ability to carry nuclear weapons. All the other Russian tactical aircraft are configured to be able to carry nuclear weapons, so the Su-57 would carry them also.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you, your research talks about the sheer numbers and the production capacity. One of the things I wrote recently about the Iskander. Apparently, and TRADOC has a write-up on this Russian weapon, which is nuclear capable from years ago, the M variant. There's a lot of reporting now about an Iskander 1000, which will double the range to 1,000 kilometers. What's your sense of the scope of the risk that provides, and how quickly could Russia produce these, and what might that mean in a tactical and strategic sense?
The Iskander is produced at Votinsk, which also produces the Russian ICBM, Yars ICBM, as well as the Balava SLBM. They produce somewhere around 100 to 600 SS-26 a year. They could easily go to 1,000 kilometers simply by reducing the size of the warhead. It, you know, basically with any rocket, it's a range payload trade-off. But if you put a low-yield nuclear weapon, 5 kT or less on the Iskander, you could increase the range to about 1,400 to 2,000 kilometers.
And since we have a science and technology focus here, one of the write-ups on the Iskander talked about it having advanced countermeasures, inertial measurement systems, different kinds of guidance technologies. What kinds of breakthroughs might there be in this realm that you would estimate could pose additional threats?
Well, the Iskander does not fly a traditional ballistic trajectory. Sort of flies like a snake. It can, in fact, maneuver in flight. Supposedly, it also has some countermeasures that it can deploy also. But I would also note that in Ukraine, both the ballistic Iskander as well as the air-launched Kinzhal have both been intercepted by the Patriot. So I think they've got a ways to go to be able to make it invulnerable, so to speak.
This episode of NuclearCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center. whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
That's excellent and an important point. And it reminds me of one of the key premises or conceptual ideas or tenets of strategic deterrence can be aligned with famous scholar Brody, which we've all heard about in the 40s, wrote about how the irony of weapons being built for the specific purpose of not being used, essentially the power to annihilate, to keep the peace, to avoid war. Well, later on, after publishing at Yale, some of Brody's work at RAND was about retaliatory, brings to mind the retaliatory possibility. If there is an ability to retaliate, that, as Admiral Richards said at a conference I showed up years ago, that's your best deterrent. If there's an ability to respond either in scope or in a massive way, you can essentially keep the peace. And what are your thoughts on that? And then I want to ask you about the Sarmats and the Russian ICBMs.
Well, first of all, when it comes to retaliation, both the U.S. and Russia have had a declaratory policy of massive retaliation. When it comes down to actually having to do it, both sides have various execution options, which are focused not on massive retaliation, burning cities, but primarily on destroying the other side's armed forces and ability to wage war. And in fact, let me quote Mikhailov, who stated, that they had changed their philosophy from high-yield weapons to low-yield and tailored effects nuclear weapons with political military utility enabled by highly accurate guidance providing usable military force. And the reason for that is because he's also further stated that the Russian strategic forces had become a burdensome pile of metal that were completely unusable. And that is why he advocated his force of 10,000 highly accurate, low-yield weapons.
Oh, that's very interesting. And when you take questions like terrain mapping or INS or levels of autonomy and increased guidance, the ability to change course in flight, potentially target moving targets, when you look at all of those things, then it adds potentially a measure of relevance to that arsenal in a way that might not have been previously anticipated. That's significant.
Yes, it is. And certainly when we look at, first of all, when you talk about ballistic missiles, particularly long-range ballistic missiles, the only way you're going to get accuracy is with a MARV or a hypersonic glide vehicle. And that then significantly cuts into your payload, but it does give you your accuracy. But if what you need is accuracy for your low-yield weapons, then that's the way you go.
You know, initially one might think ICBMs, low yield, they're not necessarily congruous, when in fact, there's a huge synergy between the two. And your expertise, your research talks specifically about this and how the avant-garde nuclear-capable weapon could be integrated into an ICBM. Of course, the Trident II D5, a low-yield variant, has already been built on the U.S. side. So can't ICBMs, thought of as these large, large weapons, be adjusted for low yield as well? And what's your sense of the Russian threat along those lines with respect to their arsenal and their modernization of ICBMs?
That issue was also addressed by one of their former commanders, which stated that groupings of ICBMs and SLBMs would appear that had highly accurate low yield weapons and perhaps even groupings of conventional ICBMs and SLBMs. And in fact, reportedly, the Balava SLBM was fitted with 50 to 200 ton, I repeat, ton warheads. But of course, for those to be effective, that then also means that they would have to have the necessary accuracy for them to be effective.
Roger that. Key point. Sure, I recall Richto talking about technical insertions with hypersonic weapons to enable future hypersonic weapons to adapt to moving targets, something that historically one wouldn't associate with these kinds of weapons. But I wanted to ask the arsenal numbers, because they're just staggering. If one looks at your research about the amount of weapons that Russia has and will continue to have. So if you could address how modernized are their ICBMs? They're clearly, as you've mentioned before, ahead of the Sentinel. And then secondly, what about sheer numbers? You double the amount of warheads by 2044, looking at some of these weapons. So it's a serious volume. By 2044, warheads looks like are doubling or do it.
Okay, for the Russian ICBM force, the SS-18 is well past its retirement age. It should have been started retiring back around 2010 or so, and certainly no later than 2018, when the Sarmat supposedly was going to start replacing it. But certainly by the 2030, the 18 will be out of the inventory. The Sarmat, as I mentioned, supposedly was going to come online in 2018. Supposedly last year, they finally deployed one. They say it's in production. However, the number of flight tests required for it to actually go into full rate production hasn't occurred, and the single silo that they have for test blew up. One of the missiles blew up in it, and so it's going to take 1 to 3 years for that to be rebuilt. It's not a question of repairing it, it's a question of completely rebuilding it. And so that's going to further delay the Sarmat. The 19 is pretty much out of the inventory, although there's 18 of those left, and they carry the Vanguard, which is a boost glide vehicle with a 2-megaton warhead, and its purpose primarily is for defense suppression. You then have the Topol, which is going out of the inventory, and it's being replaced by the Yars ICBM, and that has been largely completed. And I would note that the Yars is going to start being replaced by the Getter someplace around 2030. There's also two versions of the Yars, the S that carries three larger warheads, and the M that carries two independently boosted vehicles for improved accuracy and to evade defenses. And so that then gives you, for 2024, a total of 906 warheads, although if you upload those systems, you can get up to 2190, and that's with 326 ICBMs, although the commanding general has stated that he has 400 on combat duty. And if you look at a 2044 forecast, they will have up to 383 ICBMs, and they could carry up to 3246 warheads.
Wow. That's a wow, major jump. I wanted to ask you about the size and modernization of their ICBM force, how it pertains to GBSD or the Sentinel, because Northrop is now moving at accelerated pace to redesign, do digital engineering to look at upgrades or adaptations to the Sentinel. How far behind is the U.S. in terms of fielding an ICBM? Because this pertains to low yield as well. And what's the size difference? What's the arsenal difference in terms of the bolt out of the blue threat?
Significant. They could, in fact, have significantly more warheads than we do. Of course, if we fully upload our current systems, ICs, SLs, and bombers, we would be roughly about the same in terms of upload capability. In terms of future, a lot depends on to what degree the Russian economy is able to support, but it appears that the sanctions are in fact having an effect on Russia's ability to produce, for example, Sarmat. It certainly has impacted the modernization of their Baron Blackjack bombers and the production of new bombers, and it's impacted their SLBMs also.
Roger that. There's been a lot of discussion about all the modernization and extension programs of the Minuteman III and the pace at which the Pentagon intends to add, 400 GBSDs or 400 now Sentinels. Before we run out of time, your expert research is really eye-opening on the Chinese front. So a couple quick questions on China before we run into our time wall. One of them was, years ago, I heard General Ray, Timothy Ray, a former Global Strike Commander, talked about how he wished, or many wished, that China would come to the negotiating table and actually engage in a discussion about nuclear arms, nuclear weapons reduction. As you point out in your research, the numbers of additions are staggering, yet the ability to negotiate or the willingness to negotiate, what are they saying about it?
They've not got, have no incentive to. China has no incentive to negotiate a reduction. They aim to be able to gain parity or exceed, because their goal is future world domination, according to their own statements. And so they're going to need those forces.
Roger that. Well, the Pentagon report talks about that. By 2049, which would be the Sentinel of the People's Republic of China. But it seems like, as you point out, they're looking a little faster, potentially a little earlier than that, to sort of see themselves as the preeminent or global dominant power. I got to ask you about some of the numbers of this research. You have some really cutting-edge numbers about the H-20. Right now, the Chinese stealth nuclear bomber in its inception, early phases, R&D, as you point out. But by 2035, you anticipate, according to your research, that could carry as many as 800 warheads. So that's like a absolutely amazing jump in air attack for nuclear weapons.
Well, it's supposed to be able to carry 16 weapons. By 2035, there's no reason why they couldn't have at least 50 of those, because its IOC is supposed to be sometime in the next few years. The U.S. plans on building somewhere around, I think it's 15 B-21s a year. We actually built approximately 25 B-1s a year. So given China's manufacturing capabilities, I see no reason why they shouldn't have at least 50 H-20s by 2035 and the associated weapons.
Significant. And what about China and dual use? There are two questions I wanted to ask you about there, because your numbers, your lineup of their weapon includes the DF-26. Gosh, I wrote a few years back about the possibility, the prospect of this well-known carrier killer missile, 2,000 miles takeout carriers, anti-ship missile, that it could be configured for dual use and essentially used as a tactical nuclear weapon as well. So I'm wondering, both that weapon and ones like it. For example, Chinese papers wrote about the YJ-20, a hypersonic weapon that's already fired from naval ships, but slipped in one of the stories that was easy to miss. There's an air launch variant of that that's been traveling on the H-6. So I'd love to hear your research thoughts about dual use and low yield as it pertains to the Chinese. And what are they saying, if anything?
At various points in time, virtually all of the Chinese missiles have been characterized as dual use. China categorically states that they do not have any theater nuclear weapons, yet if they do not have any theater nuclear weapons, why do they have dual use missiles? And I believe most of them are dual use.
To include
the hypersonic ones.
Large PLA rocket force. One of the scenarios you hear about all the public war games about Taiwan is that it's likely to begin with an incoming salvo of ballistic missiles. Obviously, one wouldn't think an initial attack would be nuclear, but when you think about that arsenal, the size of those weapons, the size of that weapons arsenal, and the ability to arm them all as dual use tactical, that's pretty serious.
Yes, they're going to have very large numbers of theater missiles, both ballistic and cruise. And it should also be noted that, according to the most recent China military power report by the Pentagon, that they are in fact developing a conventional ICBM. There's no public information on it yet other than the fact that they're developing an ICBM, conventional. And you can then start thinking about what its potential utility might be as a one of the rungs in the nuclear escalation ladder.
Roger that. I remember years ago, Admiral Richard talked about public geospatial satellites, essentially Google Earth types of technologies, noticing the silos being built on mainland China. How quickly can they rival the U.S. ability with hundreds of ICBMs and silos? Clearly, there's a massive and accelerated effort underway. How far along is that? And then based on your research, what's the overall scope about how serious this threat is with the Chinese expansion?
The Chinese ICBM silo force, they built that out at approximately the same rate that the U.S. Minuteman force built out. They have, depending on who you want to believe, either 320 or 360 silos. They've all been completed and they're all being loaded.
Mr. Howe, as we wrap up, I'd really love to call in your expertise. And with all this context and all this research you've done, what are a couple thoughts that you have about the most significant threat areas, where S&T is going? What are you working on now as far as what the Pentagon anticipates are the things to really be aware of or on the radar moving forward regarding the threat equation?
Well, one of the things we need to address is simply the potential threat posed by nuclear war. Russia has, for the last 50 years, has been relying on nuclear weapons. They've been preparing for nuclear war. For the last 50 years, the U.S. has been trying to move away from nuclear weapons as fast as we can. And we are now at a point where we're going to have to rethink our posture, and we're going to need to rethink that very quickly as to how we're going to address not only Russia, but the two-tier problem with China, because it is going to require a significant increase in our nuclear capabilities, as well as our long-range strike, as well as our defenses, to cope with a two-tier and Iran and North Korea included also.
Thank you very much, Mr. James Howe, really cutting edge, very famous researcher supporting STRATCOM as well as RICTO. We really appreciate your time and expertise on this kickoff version of NucleaCast's future series. We hope you'll all come back and see the kinds of experts. And I'd like to have you back as well, Mr. Howe, to talk more at length about some of the Chinese threats and other things. So again, thank you very much. And I hope all of you were edified by this initial edition of NucleaCast Future Series, and we welcome you back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, you're welcome in any time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleaCast.